Radio.
My name is Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek. Most of the time, I make merry. I talk about goofy episodes. I talk about goofy situations. I bring my friends around, and we make light of Star Trek, one of the greatest franchises, the greatest franchise in the history of television. But rarely do I take on a big, important, popular episode. Partially out of fear because I'm going to screw it up. Partially because people know it so well. And partially because I want to make sure I get it right. But the effect of that is that I've kind of shied away from them. So a few weeks ago, I said, what the hell am I doing? What am I going to do, a 1,000 episodes of this? No. Get to the point, Mike. So tonight, I invite you to join me as I'm a little bit afraid about this, but I'm going to do the best I can to present to you one of the best, if not the best, episodes of Star Trek ever created in the past 50 years. Join me as we go to the 23rd century and then back to the 20th century as we visit the city on the edge of forever. You know, I've been trying to do this podcast, I've been thinking about this podcast for a long, long time. There's a couple of them I've been really trying to swing for the fences for. One is on the Lost Swim of Star Trek, and I've teased that a bunch of times, and I swear to you, once my jobs are done, I have a couple of jobs that are coming to a close finally, and once I'm done with those, I'm going to dedicate a lot of time to doing a really good job on it because it's a really fascinating subject. And this is one of the other ones. And a couple months ago, I was thinking to myself, wow, you know, I mean, I've done so many episodes, but I haven't really swung for the fences one of these big ones. I did The Balance of Terror. I've done a couple other ones, but really I've done the lighter, goofier ones, episodes of Star Trek. By the way, these are all talking about episodes of Star Trek. But I didn't really go for it because I was kind of afraid and because I wanted to be precious about it. I wanted to hold on to these because, you know, once you talk about it, it's kind of done. It's kind of solidified. And going back over it would be a little bit redundant. And there's 700 episodes and, you know, 14 movies and animated series and you know, derivative books and fan films and all sorts of stuff. So, and a new series coming up. So why would you go back and do it again? Why would you go back and do anything again? Because you want to get it right. Right? But sort of like in Year of Hell with Kurtwood Smith trying to go back over and over and over again, trying to fix it, I realized I didn't think I could do that. I didn't think I finally came to this epiphany. And to be honest, I recorded this a couple days ago. I did like 20 minutes of this podcast and then I've thrown it all away because I was tentative about it. I was like, oh, am I getting it right? Am I doing it exactly the way I want to do it? Because I want this to be something special. But if time has proven anything to us, it's that the mistakes that we make in the here and now are just as important as the perfection we create. You can quote me on that. That's actually a pretty damn good quote that I kind of created. And so it's with this sort of bravado that I'm just going to go ahead and plow through this monumental, wonderful episode as best as I can in an impromptu, extemporaneous fashion. I have a bunch of notes. I've actually worked on this for a while. And even though I'm afraid that I'm going to screw something up or I'm going to become derivative or I'm going to like, jangle on like this, and that word doesn't even work. I don't care because I love this episode and I want to talk to you about it. I haven't watched this episode for a long time because it has been on a series of lists. Every 10 or 15 years, they come out with these lists, these Star Trek lists, you know, the best Star Trek episodes. And there's always like five that are always on. There's always the top five, the Balance of Terror, maybe Troubled Tribbles, and then the TNG episodes like maybe Relics, but definitely The Inner Light, Best of Both Worlds. Deep Space Nine will have In the Pale Moonlight. Voyager will have Year of Hell 1 and 2. I don't even know what Enterprise has. I'm sure it has something there. I like In a Mirror Darkly. Is that the one it's called where they go to the... you know, it's the alternate universe one, the mirror universe one. Deep Space Nine, the mirror universe, we'll talk about that. But inevitably, this episode pops up top three. Sometimes it's number one, sometimes it's number three, sometimes it's number two, but it's in the top three. I covered all three of those numbers, didn't I? So I'm safe by saying it's in the top three. It's always in the top three. So to tackle this one gives you a little bit of pause. And so I stayed away from it because I was like, I don't want to watch it. Because if all the kids want to, like, oh, it's what everyone else is watching. You don't want to be a part of that. You want to be a hipster, right? Like, oh, well, my favorite's actually, you know, this one, which is actually the 25th most favorite one. I really like Assignment Earth because blah, blah, blah. I don't like Assignment Earth. But, you know, an example, you want to like something that no one else likes. So I didn't watch this one for a long time. And then I said, what the hell am I doing? I'm in episode, like, 59 of this podcast. I haven't talked about The City on the Edge of Forever. What the hell am I doing? So I'm going to talk about it tonight. It's midnight today. It's Thursday, May 25th, 2017, 12:05 in the a.m. I'm drinking a little bit of Sprite. And I'm going to tell you about it. And I'm not going to break it up. Well, I will break it up into, like, little bits and pieces. But I'm just going to go through it. Because I want you to hear my excitement. And if you have directed someone else over here to listen, and if you've never listened to a podcast about Star Trek, or if you've never seen Star Trek, I want you to feel that energy and that passion that I have for this episode. Because when I did watch it, I fell in love with it all over again. It is a great episode. It's a great piece of television. You know, Harv Bennett said that a third of the original episodes were absolutely garbage, like ridiculous. A third of them were standard television. A third of them were transcendent. And this one, for sure, is beyond it. It transcends transcendence. Sorry, I burped. That's, you know, that is a cause and effect from drinking Sprite. This podcast is actually not brought to you by Sprite. It should be brought to you by Tula. Come, Tula. All right. But I fell in love with this again. I watched it a bunch of times. And so I just kind of want to talk a little bit about it and tell you why I love it and tell you some things that maybe you didn't know, maybe you did know about it. And see if you love it just as much as I do, if you fall in love with this, or if you've never seen it before, watch it first. You know, don't listen to this podcast first. Watch the episode first. Do me a favor. Stop everything. Turn on CBS All Access or Hulu or Netflix or buy the DVD or do whatever you can. Buy it on iTunes, $2.99, whatever it is, and watch this episode. Because if you want to know why people like Star Trek, you can watch The Inner Light and The City on the Edge of Forever. Period. End of paragraph. Those two episodes, I would say, represent where the passion comes from. There are other episodes, like I said, like The Balance of Terror, The Best of Both Worlds, where you see a science fiction attitude, a science fiction slant towards things, Darmok Jalad, but these two find the heart that is missing in science fiction, that's so easy to be missed. I just saw Alien Covenant last night. I didn't know what the hell was going on in that film. I mean, I did, but I didn't care about any of those characters. I didn't know what they were doing. I don't know. Like, I cared maybe about the robot the most. I mean, what the hell? Why do I have more of an affinity towards a robot than I do towards my characters, the humans? But with City on the Edge of Forever, you care for every single one of those four major characters who are on screen. And one of the beautiful things about this is the economy of this episode. This is actually the most expensive episode produced. But the economy of the characters and how we get to luxuriate ourselves in who those characters are and find out what makes them tick. And when the most difficult decision comes up, our hero makes one that's the most painful, but also the one that is right, presumably. Okay, let me go a little bit into this. So my first chapter I was going to do is going to talk a little bit about time travel before that. And again, this seems a little presumptuous now, but what the heck, let's do it, because I have it on this this Google document. One of the interesting things about this, and I kind of went back and just did a cursory study of time travel in science fiction. I don't know if there's, you know, I don't know, like romance fiction, I guess. I guess now they have Outlander, which has, you know, romance time travel fiction. But time travel up until this point in time was used sparingly and as a device which was focused but not character related. Maybe I'm even wrong about that. There are some examples. We have Rip Van Winkle, a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. We have H.G. Wells with The Time Machine. We have that TV show by Irwin Allen called The Time Tunnel. A Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury. Peabody and Sherman. That's a pretty good example, right? Where they go back in time and they visit characters, or they go forward in time in things like H.G. Wells, where they just go forward in time and he never goes back. But their connection to the events is never one which they affect. Nowadays, when you watch, see, like, let me back up here again. See, this is where I may be making a little bit of a mistake, or I should just stop this. I should stop it right now. Let me make sure it's going. It is going. I should stop this podcast and say, whoa, 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 Mike, slow it down. Figure out what you're trying to say. But no. I'm not going to do that. Time travel now, when I say time travel to you from someone in 2017, you immediately have a picture of 15 different TV shows or movies or books or podcasts that deal with time travel. Everyone deals with time travel. The Terminator series, Back to the Future, all these various Star Treks. I mean, Men in the High Castle, Outlander, like I said. Everything deals with time travel. Doctor Who. Doctor Who is actually a franchise which is 2 years older than Star Trek, and it was all about time travel. So, but back then, that was a kid's show, Doctor Who, by the way, at the time, and then became more of an adult show later on. But back then, time travel was something which is new and unusual. Remember that just 15, 20 years ago, the atom had been split and used for devastating purposes, and we were in a brave new world. So the idea of time travel was mysterious and exotic. Now it's like, oh, sure, everything's time travel. It's like with that TV show, Timeless, and Time After Time, based on a Nicholas Meyer movie, which is pretty good, by the way. It's not bad. But back then, it was different and not utilized in the way that we think of now. Now, every single character is placed in a conundrum. Every single character has multiple timelines they have to deal with. That's what it's all about. But back then, the idea of splitting a timeline, and what we talk about with that, I think we obviously understand. I can even say these things to you, and you probably have a frame of reference what I'm talking about, that you go back and you do something which changes the timeline. That's what Marty McFly did, right? That's what they did in Terminator, right? But then Terminator got kind of a mess. And that is sort of the perils of time travel stories, that eventually it doesn't make any sense. The Flash does it too. My kid loves The Flash. Legends of Tomorrow. There is an endless supply now of time travel stories. But not back in 1966. In 1966, there's only a few. And the stories they focused on was mostly plot-driven, not character-driven. So when they got to this one, they knew it was something special. All right, so let's slowly slide into, and I realize I'm going to have like a little S sound here whenever I say my, well, don't even worry about that, forget about that, erase it from your memory. So part two, let's talk about the actual making of The City on the Edge of Forever. First of all, the title is a little bit of a nonsensical non sequitur if you think about it. The City on the Edge of Forever, what does that mean right now? I mean, it actually referred to an earlier draft where there was a city that they went to, that the Enterprise went to, which was then in tandem with New York City. Maybe they should have called The Cities on the Edge of Forever. But right now, when they go there, it doesn't make that much sense. And so it becomes a sort of prosaic, you know, flowery phrase, which is great. Star Trek, the original series, had great titles, some of the best titles. For the world is hollow and I have touched the sky. Let that be your last battlefield. Bad episode, great title. The Way to Eden, and the child shall lead him, the children shall lead him. All great titles, not necessarily the best one. Plato's Stepchildren, But The City on the Edge of Forever, in some ways, since it did become somewhat non sequitur because they pulled out elements of the original story, it becomes something exotic itself, something unusual. What does that mean? What does that mean to me? I mean, it's a series of words which don't necessarily have a connection to the story. A more apt title would probably be The Woman on the Edge of Forever. Or The Girl on the Edge of Forever. I went back and forth on that. I mean, like, girl is obviously somewhat derogatory, I suppose, now, or you know, a little simplistic. But there's The Girl in the Train, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But The Woman on the Edge of Forever is more apropos for this. But nevertheless, around early 1966, Harlan Ellison submitted an idea for The City on the Edge of Forever. And man, it was gangbusters. Roddenberry, D.C. Fontana, Dorothy Fontana, Gene Kuhn, Robert Justman all loved it. But it was not a Star Trek episode. Let me read you a little bit about what he submitted here. And actually, let me go back a little bit. So Gene Roddenberry wanted to make the sci-fi show go. He really wanted to. So he contacted a bunch of well-known science fiction authors, like Isaac Asimov. Had a lot of correspondence with Isaac Asimov, even though he never wrote an episode. Richard Matheson from The Twilight Zone, Theodore Sturgeon, all these great sci-fi novelists and short story writers from the time, because he wanted to get the best stories, because he knew that this show had to be different. It couldn't be Lost in Space. It couldn't be Space Cadet. It couldn't be Flash Gordon. It had to be something better. So he tried to get the best. And one of those was Harlan Ellison, who at the age of, I believe, 30, was at his peak, writing stories like For I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. And he wrote a couple other things. See, now I don't have that. I don't have it right now. I apologize for that. I suppose it's here somewhere. He wrote a lot of stuff. He's written over 1,700 short stories and novels. A Boy and His Dog, he would write later on. Great movie. Great, crazy, batshit crazy movie. Does not follow conventional storytelling. Keep that in mind as we move forward on this. So Gene Roddenberry solicited all of these artists. Keep that in mind as well. People who weren't necessarily television ready, although he had written for The Outer Limits. I believe he wrote The Glass Hand, I believe. And I think Robert Justman had worked with him. So they did know each other. They didn't know, they weren't dealing with an absolutely unknown element. But Harlan certainly was a firecracker. But he submitted a gangbuster outline that was not necessarily ready for Star Trek. Let me see if I can read what this is here. I don't have this on my notes, do I? No, of course I don't. All right, so suffice to say, I'm just going to paraphrase a little bit. And what it is, it starts off with this crew member, I believe named LeBec or something like that, who is a drug dealer. He's a drug dealer on the Enterprise. And he's selling drugs to this guy, and he ends up murdering him. Okay, so already we've got some weirdness with Star Trek. He beams down to this planet, which is the city on the edge of forever. And Kirk and company beam down after him, and they find this city. This city with these 12-foot-tall aliens, these guardians, who say, like, oh, we are the guardians of time. We take control of time and all that sort of stuff. And in the third act, or the second act, LeBec jumps through this portal and into the past. He jumps in the past, and this woman by the name of Edith Koestler, somehow changes the future so that the Enterprise no longer exists. Kirk and company go into the time vortex, I believe it was called, and find him, but the woman has to die, and they come back in the end. Oh, but one important thing is that Kirk falls in love with this girl, but he's trying to, when the car comes that's going to hit her, he wants to save her, and Spock stops him. That's a crucial, crucial change from what the original, what the eventual episode turned out to be. So he submitted this. Harlan Ellison submits this story, and they're like, this is great, Harlan. But it's not Star Trek. Take another pass at him. So that was in January, February of 1966. March of 1966, after 2 months, he finally submits another draft. And it's good, but it's still not Star Trek. In addition, it's really way too expensive. Way too expensive. I said, Harlan, you got to fix this. You got to do something about this. And he hems and haws. And, as a writer, as a novelist, you don't have to respond to anybody but yourself. You write it and you send it off. And if an editor says, hey, you need to cut this, do that, you have the option of either cutting it or saying, I'm going to submit it to somebody else, or I'm not. You just put it away. But here, for television, there's a set amount of rules which they will pay you for to follow. Harlan had a difficult time doing that. They went so far as to put him into a room in the studio so he could write, because he was procrastinating so much. In fact, he even wrote a book about his time there. He was 6 weeks in there, where he was in this little closet-like room, and he had a record player. We played jazz music every day and typed a couple of sentences, and then went down to the set and hung out with Kirk or with Shatner and Nimoy and had a grand old time. Turned another draft, still wasn't it. He was getting closer, but it was still way, way over budget. He had mastodons walking through the scenery. He had huge mobs running around. He had all sorts of color footage of scenes which had never been shot before through time. None of it worked. And still the giant aliens and all that sort of stuff. And most importantly, Kirk and Spock were very combative with each other. They were not getting along. This is not what they needed. So they finally sent him away, and the other writers took a pass at him, which is what happens. This is what I do now. I do writing. I write every once in a while for TV shows, and you have to learn to let go of your babies in television. You have to come up with an outline, a beat sheet, an outline, and then a draft, and then you have to let it go because a story editor or the creator of the series will overwrite you and completely rewrite you sometimes. Sometimes what you start out with, it'll be like nothing. It'll come out like nothing like what you planned. And you have to be okay with it because, as Don Draper says, that's what the money's for. It's kind of a weird phrase. But they do that because they have to conform to what television is, which is 52 minutes back in 1966 of television set in five acts with commercial breaks, with action and adventure and love and passion and romance all crammed in to a story circle like Dan Harmon arc. You had to pull that off for a budget and with characters who you could relate with and plan to see the next week and still love them. And Harlan didn't quite hit that target. So other writers came in. Steve Karabatsos, Dorothy Fontana, Gene Kuhn came in, took a pass. Gene Roddenberry took a pass at it. They all took a pass because they loved the story and because, honestly, they needed Harlan Ellison's name to drive up interest for this series. Harlan didn't like this. He didn't like the changes that were made. He tried to take his name off it. He didn't. I'm gonna hold on to this part about Harlan Ellison for a while and push it towards the end, but suffice to say, he was not thrilled with this. And in fact, the whole process had taken almost a year. I paused the podcast, by the way. I'm not going to lie about that. I needed to kind of collect my thoughts just for a minute. I'm still pushing forward, but I actually needed to drink a little more Sprite. I needed to figure out what the hell I was talking about. But this process, normally like when you, from pitch to script to filming takes like 2 to 3 months. You pitch an idea, you know, you write, take a couple of passes at the drafts and out the door goes, and then they film it, boom. You know, the whole thing takes a few months and boom, it's out there. This was one of the first stories that was offered and was slotted to be like the third or fourth story. It took almost a year for this to get finished. I mean, it was commissioned in March of 1966 for the outline. The first outline was turned in. And then in February of 1967, they started filming it. 11 months went by. And that seems like that is a recipe for a disaster. I mean, if this script is plodding along, if it takes five writers to get it together, this can't be a good script. And yet within the script itself, there's something that Spock says, which is sort of akin to how the script works, in that talking about time, he says that there's a theory that certain moments in time have a connection, have a draw to it, pull in events. And I have to think that this script created one of those eddies in time where everything was drawn to it to make it perfect. Because if this had been written and shot as the third or fourth or seventh episode, I don't think it would have been as good. If it had been shelved for a year or two and done as a third season episode, for sure wouldn't have been done as well. It would have been like, well, it was pretty good. But this episode, when it was finally written, when the pre-production was done, I think it was Joseph Pivney was the director, who was a great director. When everything was finally ready, and they used, as I said, this is the most expensive one because of all the sets they had to wrangle, and they were able to get Joan Collins for this, sister of Jackie Collins, the novelist. When everything pulled together, it was in some ways perfect. And one of the most important things is that the cast had a chance to develop into their roles, which then informed the writers to write towards those characters. Had this been the third or fourth episode, you might have had a more bellicose Spock who's like, shields up, Captain. Remember, he used to shout in the beginning. You might have had a more tempestuous Captain Kirk, or, you know, his reactions might be different. Even Dr. McCoy might have been a little off and not as laid back as he was once he's clear of the cortisone, you know, overdose. The actors themselves might not have been relaxed enough because this is their 28th episode that they're filming. By this point in time, they had a rhythm. Everyone had a rhythm, even the crew. Everyone knew what this show was about. And they could see the home stretch. They were like, they're two episodes away from being done. And so when this one showed up, it was at the right place at the right time. And it was all about time travel. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the episode itself. Let's go through this episode and what makes it so good internally. So I'm just going to kind of roll through this a little bit and we'll deal with it as it goes. So we start off basically with the Enterprise kind of looking at this planet, this undefined planet. This planet doesn't actually have a name. I don't think they've ever given a name. And they're out there just sitting there enduring these time waves that are buffering the ship because time waves buffer ships. Not, you know, I mean, honestly, in Star Trek, time waves do buffer ships. I mean, we've seen it in Star Trek IV. You know, we've seen it like in First Contact. I mean, these waves, they're pretty rough. They're pretty rough. In Alien Covenant, they had these neutrino waves, which battered the ship. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. And then later on, they call it a solar flare and whatever. It doesn't make sense. But these time waves are battering the ship. And they should go away. But this is such an interesting event for Mr. Spock that Kirk decides to stick around for a little while. Which is great because for science, sure, whatever. But then we have a panel exploding on the bridge. Now, I want to take a minute here because it injures Mr. Sulu. And this starts the wonderful, wonderful invention of panels exploding on the bridge. If every time you hit a pothole, your airbag deployed or your stereo exploded, that would be akin to what happens in Star Trek. Every single time something moderately bad happens, something explodes on the bridge of the ship. The most important part of your ship. And it explodes. Now, people have tried to rationalize, says, oh, well, there's plasma conduits that go through the control panels. You don't need that. You don't need plasma conduits. I mean, I don't need gasoline in my steering wheel in order to drive my car, all right? That's my analogy I'm going to make. But you know what? That stuff, it visualizes the escalation of the stakes in a show. In a Star Trek episode. When things are exploding, when the lights are flickering, man, you know, shit's going down, right? Because, I mean, Worf can tell you how low the shields are, which is, again, a ticking clock. You know, shields at 87%, you know, 26%. Like, what does that mean? But when stuff starts exploding, that's something serious. So this panel explodes and Sulu gets knocked to the ground. And so rather than get the first aid kit from the bridge, which, of course, doesn't exist, there's never been a first aid kit on any bridge of any Enterprise or Defiant or Voyager. Any Federation ship, there's no first aid box. There's no defibrillator. Nope, none of that stuff. They call for Dr. McCoy. They also don't beam these people straight to sick bay. Instead, the smart thing to do is to take that person and have them sit there while they have someone come all the way from sick bay up to check them out. That's okay. We got to get to the story, right? So McCoy shows up and Sulu's heart is fluttering. So they need to give him cortisone. And cortisone is good for the heart in small doses. Excuse me, I burped again. It's good for the heart in small doses, but woe be it the person who takes too much cortisone because then it can inflict paranoia upon you and feelings of persecution and feelings that people are going to murder you and give you big weird blotches all over your face and make you a pale skin. So you don't want to get that. Now, McCoy, knowing this and talking about it, still loads up a hypospray with about 900 cc's, even though Sulu needs like two. But, you know, maybe, you know, he wants to give him an extra jolt, maybe a little bit for him, you know, to kind of calm his nerves, whatever. So he gives him a little jolt and then Sulu flutters his eyes and wakes up like a prince, you know, waking from a long slumber with a big smile on his face. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's, you know, if you're going to watch that episode, watch that moment when Sulu wakes up with a smile on his face. Good for you, Sulu. So he wakes up, everything's okay, but then there's one more time wave that Spock tells us about, and boom, McCoy injects himself by accident. Oh boy. The full-on hypospray. Ugh. It's rough. It's rough. He goes down and we don't know what's going to go on. but this is outstanding that he did this, because then we get full on DeForest Kelley. Let me tell you something. DeForest Kelley was an accomplished actor before he showed up to Star Trek, and he knew his stuff. He was part of the studio system right before it ended. Studio system is where they'd actually take in actors, the studios, and they would actually give them classes, like dance classes and singing classes and acting classes and all sort of great stuff. In exchange, they pay you like a weekly rate. It was great. What a great idea. And then they put you like, oh, let's put you in a Western. Let's put you in a dancing movie. Let's put you in a gangster movie. You know, like wherever we need you, we'll put you because we think you're a good actor. It's great. It's too bad they don't do it anymore. It would be great to be part of the studio system. He was part of the studio system. So he learned how to act and how to react and how to be like just a person who just accepted whatever circumstance was given to him. When he goes full on DeForest, man, he is great. Listen to him when he wakes up.
Empty. Communications, emergency medical team.
Killers! Assassins! I won't let you! I'll kill you first! I won't let you! Mm-hmm. You won't get me! Killers!
Security alert.
Yes. Yes. Listen to D go batshit crazy. He jumps right into frame. Killers! Assassins! So good! Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Killers! Assassins!
He sort of says assassins, doesn't he? Assassins! What does he say? Assassins! So good. So good. And so disarming that even though there's like a whole bridge full of competent people, including security people, he's able to like terrify them and escape into the turbo lift and then like get away. The doors, like turbo lift doors are very intuitive. They know when to close for dramatic effect. Nothing closes and they cannot get to him. He escapes. He goes on the run. He's running around all through the ship. And eventually he gets to the transporter room. And then we have another great Dr. McCoy / DeForest Kelley maneuver. So he's coming in there. And I believe it's Lieutenant Kyle or Petty Officer Kyle is sitting there in the transporter with his back turned. Again, the door opens. He doesn't hear it. He's working on something. And, you know, we've seen double-fisted punches. We have seen karate chops to the neck. We have neck punches. Vulcan neck pinches. We have stepping out to Eden, thumbs to the back of the neck. But DeForest Kelley has something that was not seen before or after. It is a kick-ass way to knock out somebody. He pulls off this karate chop first to the kidneys and then to the neck. And it's quick. It's like pop, pop. Kidneys, neck. Kitty's neck, and Kyle goes down, man. I mean, everyone's so like, oh my God, this neck pinch is so incredible, Mr. Spock. And McCoy, he's got this whole other like McCoy chop chop. And it just knocks him out. It's like even better than like the neck pinch, because the neck pinch people have like they have like an overreaction, they overact, and then they fall down. But this, he's like pop pop, and then the guy's down. And then McCoy beams himself down to the planet because, you know, the entire ship is filled with killers and assassins. Okay, so they figure out he beams down to the planet. And I guess rather than finding him and beam back up, maybe I can't remember if there's some sort of ionic interference or time vortex interference, stuff like that. They decide to beam down and go get him. Again, this is always one of those weird problems with stepping out to Eden. Like, why don't you just beam him back up? I don't know. So they beam down, and this is also kind of weird. Instead of beaming down like a security team or a medical team, even better, they beam down Kirk, Spock, Scotty, Uhura, and a couple of security guards. Because why not, right? You need an engineer, you need a communications officer, a science officer, and your captain for... Hey, it's totally cool. I mean, to this day, I don't quite understand why Scotty or Uhura are down there. But you know what? It makes for a nice look there. So they beam down and they get down to this crazy planet, which is filled with ruins, R-U-I-N-S. And they're looking around, and in the middle of all these ruins, R-U-I-N-S, is this big donut. It looks like a big donut, right? Either that, or if you Google the, I believe it's the Oscars, the set for the Oscars, I believe in 2015. It looks like the Guardian Forever. Maybe I'll post that. Oh, by the way, Facebook, check out our Facebook page. I just want to talk about Star Trek. You can tweet me at Mike McCafferty. Tell me some interesting stuff or tell me that I'm totally wrong about all this stuff, but I'm not. I'm not. So there's this giant donut there, which actually Matt Jeffries was usually the production designer for all of Star Trek sets and stuff, but he was gone for the week, so another guy did. I can't remember his name. And he kind of messed up a lot of the interpretation of what this was supposed to be. It was supposed to be, according to Harlan Ellison, this giant portal with a lot of ruins, R-U-N-E-S, which is sort of glyphs or writing around it. And he interpreted it as R-U-I-N-S, ruins. So he threw a bunch of Roman columns in some sand in the foreground and background and built this weird donut thing. But you know what? It's actually not that bad. I mean, I know Jeffries hated it. Matt Jeffries, the set designer, hated it. But the more I look at it, the more I think, you know, it's pretty cool, especially when it lights up. It actually looks really cool when it lights up. And when the guy who's talking, who's doing the voice, does it. I mean, it's a dramatic effect. Because they're sitting around, they're looking around for McCoy, and they ask, they say, well, I wonder what this thing is, or something like that. And then it comes out and it says, a question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question. I didn't memorize that. I wrote that down. So this is the Guardian of Forever, which is a kick-ass name, right? We should all be so lucky to eventually be called the Guardian of Forever. And the Guardian of Forever is sort of a time portal slash chronologer, I guess. It's sort of a window through time through which they can see stuff. And it goes on to explain, we can look at Earth's history. And so it starts to show them Earth's history. Oddly enough, some of Earth's history seems to look like black and white footage, stock footage from the Paramount film stock library. But nonetheless, it shows them all of Earth's basically history through humanity. Now, this is where Harlan Ellison wanted to have like mastodons running around and dinosaurs fighting and all sorts of stuff like that. And they're like, Harlan, we cannot do that. So basically what it is they basically kind of superimpose this footage through this giant hole. And you kind of have an approximation of history or history through the Paramount stock footage library. This is all well and good. And then they finally capture Mr. Killer's assassins. I won't play that again. McCoy. And they're still staring at it. They're like, oh my God. And Spock decides to finally start recording it. He's like, I've been a fool. And he starts recording it, which gives McCoy enough time to wake back up and dive through the portal. And boom, he's gone. I'm like, whoa, where the hell did he go? I don't know. Well, we better contact the ship. But the ship is gone. And why is the ship gone? Because McCoy has gone into the past and changed the future. Now, again, this for 2017 makes total sense. We all get it, sure. But back then, this was stunning. The Enterprise was no longer there because something Dr. McCoy had done in the past had changed the future. Now, of course, oddly enough, I guess on the planet, there's sort of like a little bubble. There's always a bubble where our heroes can realize that something has changed, right? Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Like no one would be aware of the fact that time has changed. Maybe in this universe, time has changed. Maybe, like for example, an election went one way when it should have gone another way. And we're not aware of that. And someone needs to change that. I don't know what I'm talking about. Who does, right? But time has changed, and they can't go to the ship because there is no ship. And what a great way to end that act. Especially with Kirk looking up, and they have this Twilight Zone ending of the act with him looking up, and there's just a star field there. There's no ship. Okay, so they've got to go back and they got to go find him, but they can't do it as it. Here's like a weird thing: like this Guardian of Forever has been around for like a billion years, but it can't slow down time. It can do all sorts of stuff. I can, when you're done with your job, I can pull you back, and I know the fact this is kind of screwed up time. But I cannot slow down the way I play stuff back. I got one speed. So they have to sort of approximate when they jump in and go after McCoy. So they do. They jump in and they arrive in the 1930s. You know, there's an interesting sort of like parallel between this and Back to the Future where it's been like 30 years for each. 1985 to 1955. This was 1967 to 1930. So around like a 30-year time period seems to be a good time to go back because people know it. and it has enough nostalgia so that people can look back on it and have some degree of ownership over being able to laugh or understand what happened back then. I mean, I suppose now if we went back to 1987, you know, people would say, aha, I understand that time period enough that young and old can have a grasp on it. People who have lived that era, I don't know who those people are, Kim, can understand it. And people who weren't alive then still know enough about it through their parents or through Kim that they would understand it. So they go back to the 1930s. And I'm stopping a little more as I go on because I am just on a roll here. But sometimes I need my brain to catch up a little bit. And it gives me a chance to stop and think about what's important about this moment right here when they go back in time. They realize they're in the 1930s, United States, New York, and they look totally out of place. And this is one of the significant things about The City on the Edge of Forever, which is great, and which science fiction sometimes misses, the humor. Gene Kuhn did a pass on this, and he loved writing humor for the episodes, and he went on to write a lot of other funny stuff, killers, assassins. But he injected humor at this point in time, which I feel was crucial, because up to this point in time, it had been heavy, right? I mean, McCoy, you know, he's gone crazy. City on the Edge of Forever, you know, Guardian Forever, weird. McCoy jumps through this. The Enterprise has gone so many high stakes. You need to relieve that with a little bit of humor. When I was watching Alien versus Covenant, I always want to call it Alien versus Covenant right now. But when I was watching that, one of the things that I missed was the humor. Think about the movie Aliens, where we have the wonderful Bill Paxton, rest in peace, Bill Paxton. He brought such a levity to it, such a lightness, that it gave the audience a chance to kind of relax a little bit and say, okay, so we don't have to focus so much on this. We can actually relax and have a bit of fun. And so Kirk and Spock being out of place through time travel, and, you know, Star Trek had done time travel before. They had tested the waters with the Naked Time. They'd gone back with Return to Tomorrow. And had bits of humor in there as well. But here they really got to kind of stretch their legs. Now, they have a scene with a police officer where Kirk comments on Spock's ears as being damaged in a Chinese rice picker. We're going to let that just kind of sit there as it is. We will make no further commentary on that. But the rest of the scene is lighthearted and fun because our erstwhile heroes are out of their element and they're fumbling to figure out what the hell to do. So they run. They grab the clothes and they run. They don't know what to do. I mean, I guess they could have like stunned them with their phasers or whatever, but no, they just run because they don't know what the hell's going on. Maybe they're going to change some of the past. They run inside this mission, 21st Street Mission. And here's where the story really kicks into high gear. Because this is the mission that is run by one Edith Keeler. This story has to be counterbalanced. This is a love story. At the heart of The City on the Edge of Forever is a story about love. It is a story about love, which is ultimately doomed. And when you have established characters like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy sitting on one end, you have to counterbalance it with a strong enough character. And Edith Keeler, Edith Kostler at first, but Edith Keeler is so even keeled. There's been some conjecture that her name was Keeler, as in keel of a ship, something that steers it, because she did. She did steer this ship. She was able to establish a balance to this. And more importantly, she was a match for Captain Kirk. Listen to this little sequence here where Kirk lies right off the bat and she calls him on his ship.
Excuse us, miss. We didn't mean to trespass. It's cold outside.
A lie is a very poor way to say hello.
Burn.
It isn't that cold.
No. We were being chased by a policeman.
Why?
These clothes. We stole them. We didn't have any money.
Well, I could do with some help around here. Doing dishes, sweeping, general cleaning.
At what rate of payment?
At what rate of payment? Wow, isn't that a great little passage right there? So we have Captain Kirk instantly meeting his match because he lies. He has his like bullshit lie about, you know, you were cold or whatever. And she says a lie is a terrible way to say hello. And it's such a great phrase that it totally disarms Captain James Tiberius Kirk. Fictional womanizer. And I'm saying that fictional because, you know, there's actually someone actually put out an article a little while ago talking about how Captain Kirk wasn't a womanizer, but that the common narrative has been that he is a womanizer. In fact, he's not. He's not. He really didn't have that many romantic liaisons. Now, he certainly was attracted to women, but I'll get into that a little bit later about what's, you know, why he never really finished the deal on a lot of those. I guess that whoever did this article kind of said that he only like really, you know, made love with like three or four women, and Edith Keeler might have been one. But she totally disarms him, and he just tells the truth after that. He can't. There's something so magical about her that he can't not tell her the truth. And so she offers them a job, and Spock follows it up with a great piece of comedy. At what rate? He's totally undercutting this romantic situation. This is a great scene. It's a great way to introduce Edith Keeler. And as I said before, Edith is a great counterbalance to Captain Kirk, but she's also something special and different. And it took me many, many years to realize that Edith is something even beyond just romantic interest to Captain Kirk, that there's almost something magical about her. And I don't know, maybe it's just not fully realized what they're trying to get at with her from a writing standpoint. Maybe it was just the combination of various other writers. Harlan Ellison said that he could tell that it was Roddenberry putting all this stuff about, you know, the future. But Edith has such a vision for the future that it continues to mesmerize Captain Kirk. As they're kind of working at this place, she continues to say more and more interesting things, which are strangely prescient about what's to come. Listen to this.
Because the days and the years ahead are worth living for. One day soon, man is going to be able to harness incredible energies, maybe even the atom. Energies that could ultimately hurl us to other worlds in some sort of spaceship. And the men that reach out into space will be able to find ways to feed the hungry millions of the world and to cure their diseases. They will be able to find a way to give each man hope and a common future. And those are the days worth living for.
This is really kind of on the nose, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like when James Cromwell was in First Contact. He says, "You guys are on some sort of Star Trek, aren't you?" I mean, like it almost sums up exactly what Kirk and Spock are doing in their jobs in the 23rd century. So that one's a little on the nose, but it makes this mysticism about her. Who is she? How can she make that sort of prognostication about stuff? Now, Spock dismisses this one kind of out of hand, says, well, it's just kind of a lucky speculative guess. But then she has this exchange. Listen to this.
I still have a few questions I'd like to ask about you two. Oh, and don't give me that questions about little old us look. You know as well as I do how out of place you two are around here.
Interesting. Where would you estimate we belong, Miss Keeler?
You? At his side, as if you've always been there and always will. And you? You belong in another place. I don't know where or how. I'll figure it out eventually.
I'm finished with the furnace.
Captain. Even when he doesn't say it, he does.
Who is Edith Keeler? How does she know these things? I mean, even Spock, in this exchange, he starts to become aware that she is something more than what she seems. Now, I don't want to postulate it beyond what it is. Now, maybe it is just the time Eddie is kind of revealing themselves towards her. Maybe she has some sort of ESP or something like that, because, you know, ESP in the beginning of the series was something that was big. But she is something beyond what a human should be, because she senses that there's something monumental going on here. And that's what also entrances Captain Kirk, because she's like no one he's ever met. I want to stop for a minute and talk about why he loves Edith Keeler, why he starts to fall in love with her. Now, there's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons why this becomes such a beautiful love story and why it becomes such an organic and earned love story in the series is because of time within the script. Not only do they meet early on in the actual episode, but because they arrive about 2 weeks before McCoy does, this episode has time for them to breathe. Lots of times in these episodes, you know, the action takes place in a couple of days, you know, like 1 or 2 or 3 days at the most. You know, for some episodes, like there's a couple months that go by, like This Side of Paradise or The Paradise Syndrome, I should say. But this, they basically gave him like 2 weeks to build stuff. I mean, Spock says it took 30 hours to build that tricorder machine to figure out what was going on. I don't understand that, first of all. Spock needs to build a thing with all sorts of duotronic, mnemonic, weirdo stuff so he can access a tricorder. That's sort of like me building a bicycle so I can work my iPhone. I just don't quite understand that. But it does give us the clues that they are here for a long period of time, which gives Kirk and Edith time to realistically fall in love, to have those encounters that we see on camera and off as they slowly fall in love. We see them courting. We see them walking around. He holds her hand. It's so beautiful. And in fact, there are two instances where he does kiss her, and they cut it out. Two of the scenes, he's moving right in to kiss her, and then one time they cut to a shot of the New York skyline, and another time they cut to something else right before he kisses her. And it's sort of, I'm curious as to why they do it, but I think they did it so they could make this a sweeter love story. So that it's not about the potential of did they have sex, how deep was this relationship getting. But that is a very honest and earnest love story. He kisses her once, right towards the end of the episode, when she's like almost falling down a flight of steps. And you can tell that this is not the first time they've kissed, because the kiss he gives her has very little romance. It's almost like a peck. It's like, hey, I love you. I'll see you later. But why does Kirk fall in love with Edith like he's never fallen in love with anyone ever before? I thought about this a little bit, and something occurred to me. In The Naked Time, also about time travel, when Kirk is affected by that kind of weird water, which makes everyone sort of like act like they're drunk and like a truth serum, his innermost demon is his love of the Enterprise. Love, you're better off without her. This ship I give, she takes, won't permit my life, gotta live hers. Now I know why they call her she. He talks about wanting to walk on a beach and a flesh woman to touch, to hold. And then even though he's trapped by this ship of a woman at the end of that moment, as he's finally like, okay, I've got to go up to the bridge, I've got to take care of stuff, he leaves. He says, never leave you. Never. I could pull that clip, but it's all right. I know this monologue pretty well. Not that well, but Captain Kirk, his first love, has always been the Starship Enterprise. It's what he puts before anything else in this world, anything else in this universe. But in this timeline, there is no Enterprise. In this timeline, it's all gone. And the only thing that's there is Edith Keeler. So he's able to allow himself to fantasize, to play out what it would be like to be a normal person falling in love with someone. Someone as extraordinary as Edith Keeler, who can not only call him on his stuff, but it seems to be a little more than what she seems. Of course, we finally get to the second half of the second act, where we find out that, in fact, Edith Keeler is at the center of this time situation. Maybe that's why she is realizing what's going on, because she is at the crux of this time split. Now, you've seen this. I'll just tell you again, is that because she didn't die in a car accident, her efforts to stop people from fighting, from entering the Second World War, eventually led to Hitler perfecting the atom bomb with the V2 rockets. Hitler captured the world, as Spock said. And actually, if you visualize this future, it's almost like falls perfectly into The Man with the High Castle. You can almost envision that this is almost like the prequel to The Man in the High Castle on Amazon, which I stopped watching because it's just kind of boring and a little ridiculous. So all of a sudden, we have built this perfect machine of Kirk falling in love with this girl while he's waiting for his friend so he can stop this horrible thing from happening, which destroys his universe as he knows. And the thing that he's in love with now is the thing that is going to have to die. What a horrible, horrible predicament he's in. And he doesn't know when it's going to happen or how or where. But as Spock says, and I stopped it so I can pull this up, save her. Do as your heart tells you to do, and millions will die that did not die before. That's tough, isn't it? Now, meanwhile, McCoy has finally materialized, and he's running around calling murderers assassins. He runs into a guy who eventually turns out to be one of the guys from A Piece of the Action, a bum who knocks him out, but then like destroys his own phaser. That's kind of a weird subplot. And then as Spock says that there are currents and eddies in time, he is drawn to that exact same mission and finds Edith Keeler, who like lets him lay down on this bunk upstairs where they obviously Kirk and Spock don't see him. It's kind of a weird series of coincidences where they don't seem to see him. McCoy almost falls in love with her, and I guess they actually filmed a scene where he was kind of sort of falling in love with her, but it kind of messed stuff up. It muddied it too much. All we wanted to see was this love relationship between Kirk and Edith. And then we get to the end, right towards the end, where Kirk's walking Edith to see a Clark Gable movie in the 1930s, which actually is kind of anachronistic. It doesn't quite actually work because Clark Gable wasn't a big star at that point in time. And she mentions Dr. McCoy, and he says, Leonard McCoy. And then he's like, Spock, Spock. And then he runs back. And then McCoy pops out, and they all hug. And this is the cool thing. They are all legitimately happy to see each other. It's so great. You get this feeling that, like, again, as I said before, had this been episode 3 or 4, maybe they wouldn't have been good as friends. Maybe Shatner, DeForest Kelly, and Nimoy wouldn't have been as good of friends. But now, when they hug, they're actually having a good time. It's really great. And Edith walks across the street. A truck comes up. And I can't even say it. Spock sees it. I'm sorry, Shatner sees it. So I can't even say it. And McCoy's going to go save her. This is that moment of time. This is that moment of time when he was going to save her and as a result cause millions to die and the universe to change. Maybe this turns into the mirror universe. Maybe this is when, like, the ISS Enterprise is formed and evil Kirk is created and goateed Spock is created because of that split in the time. But as he's moving towards her, as opposed to Harlan Ellison's version where Spock stops Kirk from saving her, Kirk has to stop McCoy from saving the woman he loves. She's hit by a car, or a truck, I should say, driven by Eddie Paskey, by the way, driven by Lieutenant Leslie. Again, Lieutenant Leslie, very possibly a Q, very possibly one of the members of Trelane, because he set this whole thing up. Maybe he interjected himself so he could, write the timeline. But she dies instantly. McCoy says, do you know you deliberately held me back? Do you know what you've done? And Spock says, he knows, Doctor. He knows. Kirk can't bear to look back. He can't bear to see the woman he loved lying down there. Had this been a 2017 episode, he would have rushed over to her. We'd have a wonderful little love scene where, she's dying and he has to let her die. And who knows, maybe she would have said something else prophetic or something like that and she would have died. And maybe if you're watching it now with someone who's never seen the show before, it's like, oh, that's kind of weird. He doesn't even look at her. He just kind of like, you know, like looks away and like balls his fist. But for that moment, that's the moment that we needed right there. Because that's when Captain Kirk put millions of people's lives, an entire galaxy, before his own happiness. As I said just a few minutes ago, he is in love with the Enterprise. He's in love with his job. He's in love with his universe. But he allowed himself to fall into this timeline and fall in love with a woman who was doomed. And for a heartbeat, he could have stopped that. He could have risked it all for love. But he had to be the captain. He had to be bigger than his heart. And how painful is that? To have to put duty, to have to put the lives of millions of others ahead of your own feelings. It's terrible. They come back through the portal. And I want to play this whole scene because this is so powerful. It's so quiet. They come back through the portal and it's only 5 lines. But listen to it.
What happened, sir? You only left a moment ago.
We were successful.
And the Enterprise is up there. They're asking if we want to beam up.
Let's get the hell out of here.
And that's it. They line up. They get beamed out. And instead of being on the ship for some sort of humorous tag, instead of watching the ship pull away, we stay on the planet as the credits roll, as the Guardian waits again for someone to step through their portal. Step through its portal. Through the portal. There weren't very many times that they used expletives in Star Trek, especially in 1966, 1967. The, you know, standards and practices would not allow it. They used the word hell in Star Trek 4 times in the 76 episodes they did. 3 times was to refer to places. You know, it's better to serve in hell than, you know, better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. Something that, you know, was from Milton, from, you know, Space Seed. A couple other times where they said hell as a place, but not like this. Let's get the hell out of here. Again, there's such a conservation of words here. You're only gone a little while ago. What happened? Captain, I have the ship. We were successful. Time is as it was. Many such journeys are possible. Let me be your gateway. The Guardian of Forever, it makes no judgment on what happened, just that everything's been restored. And it offers to travel again as though this was nothing. There's such an aloofness to it, which helps to counterbalance Kirk's absolute pain. We sit in that moment as we have reaction shots of Scotty and Uhura and who don't know what the hell's going on. They just stepped out a minute ago and they came right back and all of a sudden everyone's like in a shitty mood and McCoy's okay. They're happy. Hey, he came back. Oh God. Oh shit. Oh, right. Okay. Now, Spock and McCoy, they know what have happened and they are devastated by this. But it's Kirk. It's Kirk who has to live with this. Let's get the hell out of here. I can't be in this place anymore. I can't think about her. About what could have been. I have my life back. I have her back. My ship. But the price was my heart. I gave that up to save the universe. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here so I don't have to think about it anymore. Let's go as far away as we can so that maybe I'll have some sort of peace from this. Many, many times it's been said that Edith Keeler is James Kirk's true love. In Star Trek Generations, there's some woman on a horse, and it's like, what the hell is that? If he's in the Nexus and he's with the woman he loves, there is no way in hell it is anyone but Edith Keeler. Maybe Miramani. Miramani was another situation, the Paradise Syndrome, where he forgot that he was captain. And again, he was allowed to love. But maybe Ruth. I don't know. Probably not Ruth. Ruth was kind of like a fling. But great song, though. But this was the love of his life. And I guess if you played all the way through, he never got to be with her again, even through the Nexus, even through getting presumably what he wanted. He wasn't able to go back to be with her. This is why this episode is so good. This is why it's so important, because Captain Kirk got the worst possible scenario and the best possible case outcome from it. It tore out his heart in front of us. We saw what his life could have been but wasn't. And we had to be okay with that. And he had to be okay with that. And it was that moment when science fiction was put aside and it was all about the human condition. This is what I worry about with Discovery, is that we'll miss these episodes where they are encapsulated, where the next day Kirk will probably go on. The next episode, I don't remember what it was, but I mean, in two episodes, he's going to lose his brother. He wouldn't even care that much about it. But this one hurt, because it's about a human being. And at the core of all science fiction, you strip it all away, and it's about the human condition. And this was about love and who Captain Kirk truly loved. Okay, we did it. We got through it. I got through it. God, I got a little emotional about this. I didn't think I was going to get this emotional about it, but boy, just talking about this, I guess, you know, my connection with Star Trek is that strong, and I do have that kinship to Captain Kirk and just going through those feelings and feeling that, and that's what it's all about. And when someone says, why do you like Star Trek? All those silly moments of fighting the Gorn and you know, shooting the phasers and eating bugs and conspiracy and all this ridiculousness. The reason we love these shows is because every once in a while they do something which just digs down to the core of what it means to be a human being. They tap into that. And it's so deep and it's so strong that it lives with you. 50 years later, I can't shake it. I don't want to. That's why we watch Star Trek. That's why we love Star Trek. And if people don't get it, then that's okay. But if they want to know why we love it, they need to watch shows like The City on the Edge of Forever. Okay, that's enough of that. We will come back later. As I said, my jobs are ending, for better or for worse. So I will have more time to podcast. I'm excited about that. Discovery's coming up. We can talk about all sorts of other great stuff. I'm looking forward to doing fun, dumb things, having the Doctor back on, having Stompy finally, having Dave, having George, having Ryan, having Dave Geis, whoever the hell I want to have on, having all sorts of cool guest stars, whoever I want. This is going to be great, because we're going to go for it. We're going to go for it. I don't know what that means. But thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. And I look forward to talking to you and at you and with you and from you and by you and for you. Because I'm Mike McCafferty. And no matter what time it is, no matter where we are, I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Completed and engaged.
Don't you understand anything?
train comes in, everybody rides.
Galileo Odell, sir, at your service.
Your daddy can put them up, can he?
Bach, a somber, emotional statement.
Killer! Assassins! I won't let you! I'll kill you first! I won't let you! You won't get me! Murderers! Killers!
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. And he's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My